I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Today on the Weekly Review, going to jail for Jesus. A Carroll County commissioner says she is willing to do just that in defiance of a federal judge's order. We'll get some legal analysis on the case from Kenneth Lassen of the University of Baltimore Law School. In another legal decision, this one involving a $1.5 billion redevelopment in Baltimore, Maryland's High Court ruled against Orioles owner Peter Angelos and other downtown property owners, paving the way for the long-delayed State Center project to move forward. We'll hear about that from the Sun's City Hall reporter, Luke Broadwater. Plus, Evergreen Health's Peter Bielenson talks about the Obamacare deadline, WIPR's Chris Connolly has a General Assembly update, and Shakespeare goes to the dogs. Literally. The Midday Weekly Review begins after the news from NPR. I'm Nathan Sterner, sitting in for Dan Rodericks and welcoming you to the Midday Weekly Review. We'll be tracking some controversies this hour. A battle over $1.5 billion worth of redevelopment project in Midtown Baltimore at the site of the state government complex. There was an important ruling by Maryland's highest court in that years-long dispute yesterday. Luke Broadwater, City Hall reporter of The Sun, will be here to tell us about it later this hour. In Carroll County, one of the county's three commissioners says she is willing to go to jail in defiance of a federal judge's order that the commissioners stop invoking Jesus Christ or any other specific deity during prayer before their public meetings. Kenneth Lassen, professor of law at the University of Baltimore, will join us to talk about that case. And public school students across Maryland have been taking sample tests of the new assessments being introduced as part of the controversial curriculum changes known as Common Core. Many of the teachers say they're still having a difficult time grasping what those changes actually are, and Common Core itself continues to be criticized. It was a subject of debate in the legislature yesterday, where there was an effort to withhold public education funds until questions about Common Core are settled. We'll talk about that later this hour with Linus Kazanjian of MarylandReporter.com. Right now, we set our sights on Annapolis. Less than 2 weeks to go in this year's General Assembly session. Chris Connolly covers the General Assembly for WIPR, and he's here now to give us an update. Hey, Chris.
How's it going?
We're going to start with marijuana. Yesterday, the state Senate approved a bill to update Maryland's medical marijuana law, a measure that was passed last year and is pretty much widely regarded as a failure because nobody has been able to get under that law, nor does it look like anyone is going to be able to anytime soon. Remind us why the current law is not working.
Right. So when they passed it, they did it in this way that said that to set up a dispensary, you have to be tied to an academic institution. No academic institutions have taken the bait and set up any kind of a medical marijuana program.
Nor really indicated that they have any desire to do so.
Exactly. And so basically what you have is the state said, you know, patients can have access to this drug that is newly legal, except for they can't get the drug.
Anywhere. So lawmakers in both chambers want to change that. That's been a priority, it seems, with overwhelming support this year.
It definitely has, because they supported it last year. You know, they said they said, listen, we did it and we did it wrong. So now they're basically have embarked on this task, this session of figuring out the best way to set up a medical marijuana industry. And it's a complicated thing. You know, different states use different models and they're, you know, dead set on doing the right thing for Maryland. But there's some disagreement about what that actually looks like.
Now, both the House and the Senate have agreed to let certain doctors essentially prescribe's not the word they can actually use, but essentially prescribe marijuana to patients. But there are significant differences between the two bills other than that.
Right. I mean, it comes down to the licenses. It comes down to how many licenses.
And that's licenses for growing marijuana?
Growing, exactly. As well as dispensing. And so the question is, how many growers you're going to license, and for how long those licenses are valid, how often they have to renew them.
In the House bill, the growers and the distributors would be the same people?
Yes. And they limited it, too. And there's 10 licenses is all that they're going to offer for the state.
You know, it's under the House bill.
This is under the House bill, yes. And so they said 10 licenses is the best way to do it, and they're for 5 years at a time. The Senate took a very different approach. They thought that would set up essentially a monopoly. They're saying, you know, we are by limiting it, we're just going to make sure that certain people get rich, but we're also worried that that's going to make the drug more expensive.
So they were also worried about the 5-year licenses, saying that would be way too long.
Exactly. If you do it in 2-year increments, it gives you more ability to adjust it, to tweak the model, to get it right. And that's what they're concerned about.
But the Senate bill didn't go to give 2-year licenses. It went for something completely different.
Yes. So they want... They want 94 licenses across the state.
That's distribution licenses. So,
yes.
And the number of people that could actually grow marijuana under the Senate bill would be...
I thought that was the 94.
Oh, 90. I thought it was 94 for distribution, and the number of 94 distribution.
Oh, sorry.
Centers.
Yes, they have an exactly. Sorry, they have 94 distributors, and it works out for something like 2 per Senate district. But an unlimited number of growers.
And they'd let the commission determine exactly what the criteria would be for that.
Exactly. I mean, and they're sort of relying on the commission to say, listen, you guys are spending all your time thinking about this, studying it, making sure that this works. And so in some ways, it's putting more authority into that body to really be figuring out the best way to do this.
Now, both the Senate and the House want some sort of new medical marijuana bill to pass. What are the prospects for reconciling these two bills?
I think they're good. You know, they have a week, essentially, to work it out. And there are strong opinions on both sides, but really, when it comes down to it, they know that they want this. They've passed, both branches have passed this twice now, saying that they want people to be able to get medical marijuana who need it. And so I think there's a lot of will to get it done. There are, of course, they're at this impasse, but...
Well, I just remember recent sessions, there was the dog bite liability bill in which both chambers wanted done, yet they couldn't figure out a way to resolve their differences.
There certainly has. And I think either way, no matter what, it's going to come down to a lot of dealing and wheeling and dealing and horse trading on sine die to get it done.
What about decriminalization? Is that going anywhere this session?
It is moving forward. It still could.
The Senate's approved the measure.
The Senate has approved the measure. The House is going to be the trickier chamber. It has to go through the Judiciary Committee in the House. And Chairman Valerio, the head of that committee, is not a fan. He doesn't want to see it go anywhere. But there's enough of a push and there's enough energy around it that it really, I think we could see it happen.
Let's go to the minimum wage now. Raising Maryland's minimum is one of Governor O'Malley's big legislative priorities this year. At the beginning of the session, he proposed a bill that would raise the rate to $10.10 an hour by 2016 and then tie it to inflation. The House would change that so it takes effect by 2017 and does not tie it to inflation, and also doesn't include increases for tipped workers like waiters, which is something O'Malley had wanted to do. Now it's in the hands of the Senate. What's going on?
Well, now it is in the Senate Finance Committee, and it is pretty much stuck there. Senate Finance Committee Chairman Mac Middleton has his own bill that he wants to see passed alongside the minimum wage bill. And he's a proponent of raising the minimum wage, but his concern is workers who care for people with developmental disabilities. And he says... He wants there to be he wants to set a wage floor that's a percentage higher than the minimum wage for people who care for people with disabilities.
Which is kind of what's in effect right now, isn't it? I mean, there's like a set rate or
there's
something.
There's a set rate. So these are state subsidized jobs. And the set rate right now is the average wage is $9.82 for these workers.
Since the minimum wage is currently, $7.25 an hour, that puts it above the minimum wage.
If the minimum wage
were to go to $10.10 an hour with nothing to be done.
There's no guarantee that these would not be minimum wage jobs once the minimum wage is fully in effect.
And people have said that these are not jobs that do not require significant training, and they are jobs that are important, and they want to make sure that people will want to do these jobs caring for people with developmental disabilities.
Yeah, these are jobs that require a certain level of education. You have to get a background check. You have to be trained. And they're hard jobs. You know, you're actually caring for a person who relies on you, who needs you. They can be... dirty jobs that, you might be helping somebody bathe, you might be feeding somebody, you might be doing household chores, but, you might also be working with somebody who has outbursts. And so there's even a threat that you may be injured doing these jobs. So there, Mac Middleton says these are not entry-level jobs. These are not, you know, these are harder than other jobs that pay the minimum wage. And so we need to be compensating people above the minimum wage so that we can attract people to these jobs and so that we can keep them doing the jobs.
So what is Middleton proposing and what is its likelihood of being enacted?
Well, so his bill proposes saying that the these workers should get 50% above whatever the current minimum wage is. It ties it directly to the minimum wage. So when the minimum wage goes up, these go up too. He has said that he's willing to compromise. And he's basically working with the governor's people right now to figure out what they can agree on. The governor wants his minimum wage bill passed. Mac Middleton says, fine, but I want these workers to also have a wage increase. And so there's, he said, he's told me that there is tentative talk, not an agreement yet, but talk about setting it at 35% above the minimum wage. Essentially, that gives Middleton this floor that is above the minimum wage, and it keeps these jobs more attractive than your average entry-level McDonald's job. But it's not quite the level that he wants.
And we've got a little bit more than a week to see what happens with that. Before we wrap the budget, $38.7 billion proposal passed the House of Delegates yesterday. Differences now have to be ironed out between the House and the Senate version. And the bills are pretty close, aren't they?
They are very close. I think that this is not going to be a tough thing to conference out.
One of the differences, though, has to do with the film and TV production credit and House of Cards.
Yeah, a little bit of a curveball, a little bit of a machination.
House of Cards, of course, the popular Netflix series that is filmed primarily here in Maryland.
Exactly. Not quite so. This move is not quite so dramatic as the things that you see Frank Underwood employing. But Bill Frick, a Democrat from Montgomery County, stood up yesterday when they were doing their final vote on the amendment on adding amendments to the budget, and said, read from the letter that Media Rights Capital, the company behind the Netflix show,
yeah, they threatened to pull out of Maryland if the credit was not increased.
Exactly, and he said, I don't like being threatened. So if they try to pull out, we're going to use the full extent of eminent domain laws that we can to say, to take their sound stages, their offices, their equipment, even maybe try to get in on some of that intellectual property.
But the House, as the Senate, did agree to increase the credit to what, $18.5 million from its seven-some million this past fiscal year?
Exactly. They definitely did. So they're still giving in.
They're giving House of Cards what it wants, but with a little bit of protest.
Exactly.
Okay, the General Assembly session ends a week from Monday, April 7th. Lots to cover between now and sine die, and you, Chris Connolly, will be on the case.
I sure will.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Turning now to Carroll County and to that ruling on the invocation of Jesus Christ during prayers before Carroll County Commissioners meetings. U.S. District Judge William T. Quarles said the Carroll County Commissioners must stop the practice of invoking the name of Jesus or any other specific deities linked to specific faiths. Kenneth Lassen, a longtime professor of law at the University of Baltimore Law School, joins us now to talk about the case and the broader debate over the limits of religious observation by government bodies. Kenneth Lassen, welcome to Midday.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us first about this complaint. Who brought the case against the commissioners and on what grounds?
Well, I just know what I read in the papers, but there was a member of the, a citizen of Carroll County, an immigration attorney who was a plaintiff in Carroll County suit, Bruce Hake, who felt that the prayers contradicted his particular religious views and made him uncomfortable at commission meetings. Hake is a Catholic, and he said, at least I'm quoting now from a story I've gotten to some papers, it's un-American to impose one flavor of religion on people, unquote. And that, I think, is a reflection of longstanding Supreme Court jurisprudence.
The Supreme Court has weighed in on this issue to some degree, right?
Yes. Most recently, actually, there have been a number of cases around the country ever since the Supreme Court, must have been about 30 years ago, upheld the right of a chaplain in Minnesota to utter a prayer. A taxpayer paid chaplain in Minnesota. But it was a very limited ruling in that case, and that was back in, I think, 1983, something like that, where the court said it was such a longstanding tradition in Minnesota that having a chaplain invoke a non-sectarian prayer was a reflection of the tradition of the Minnesota legislature, and there's nothing wrong with it. But since then, there have been a whole bunch of cases around the country which have tried to expand upon that ruling and say that, well, so long as a prayer doesn't proselytize or denigrate, proselytize in favor of religion or denigrate another religion, then it's okay. Most recently as last year, the Supreme Court heard a case that originated in the town of Greece, New York, outside of Rochester, which a prayer had been used for something like 4 or 5 years that was certainly sectarian. I mean, the name Jesus Christ and the word Savior was used often. And that case came before the Supreme Court, as I say, in an oral argument last term, and it still hasn't issued its decision, but a decision in that case is expected shortly.
I guess it comes down to the whole flavor of faith thing that you mentioned earlier, because there are all sorts of prayers at all sorts of legislating bodies all over the country, including in Congress. It comes down to how specific the prayer is.
That's right. I mean, Congress has had a prayer by the Office of the Chaplain in the House of Representatives. I happen to have a prayer in front of me that I looked up from March 27th, just yesterday, by the Reverend Patrick Conroy from the Society of Jesuits, who uttered a prayer in Congress just yesterday, and although he is a Jesuit, he wasn't specific about invoking a deity. And as it happens, even the Supreme Court opens each of its session with the clerk saying, "God save the United States and this honorable court." But that's decidedly non-sectarian, as opposed to the prayers that are being proposed nowadays in town of Greece and in Carroll County, which are certainly sectarian.
One nation under God is fine, but if you go much further.
Well, you know, one nation under God came in under the Eisenhower administration, and even that has been challenged. But the Supreme Court itself, and none other than Justice William O. Douglas, has said that we are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being, and in God we trust on the coins, has been held to be de minimis. That is, it doesn't really make much of a difference to anybody, and that's the way it's been found within God we trust, not in God we trust, but one nation under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. Doesn't make much of a difference to anybody, but when you're in front of a legislative session and or a committee and you're asking for some sort of a bill or an interest, you want to pursue an interest on your behalf or on behalf of a group, to be faced with a sectarian prayer that you have to stand up for as opposed to sitting down and making a scene, it is somewhat coercive, it seems to me.
The day after Judge Quarles barred the Carroll County commissioners from invoking Jesus in their pre-meeting prayers, Commissioner Robin B. Frazier did it anyway, did it twice, and said she was willing to go to jail for her beliefs. She said, quote, "This is an infringement on my First Amendment rights of free speech, and I think it is a wrong ruling." Could this get serious enough that she could actually be ordered to jail?
I don't think so. It sounds very dramatic, and there have been people, well, for years, we argue First Amendment cases, and what does the First Amendment mean? And in an inordinate number of cases, the Supreme Court comes down with 5-4 decisions on cases involving the First Amendment. So there are arguments both ways, but is somebody going to go to jail for it? I don't think so. Might make the newspapers, and I'm sure some conservative commentators would pick it up and say that she's a real hero for doing this. But it seems to me that she's just making a scene.
Kenneth Lassen is a professor of law at the University of Baltimore. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
More Midday is coming up in a moment. Before this hour is out, we'll tell you about a place in Baltimore where pet adoption meets Shakespeare, an effort by the Humane Society to find homes for dogs by giving them roles in the plays of the Bard. Before that, we're going to be joined by Dr. Peter Bielenson. The former Baltimore Health Commissioner and Howard County Health Officer now runs the Evergreen Health Insurance Cooperative. We'll speak to him as the deadline for enrollment in health plans under the Affordable Care Act draws near. Peter Bielenson and Obamacare. After the break, stay tuned. It's the Midday Weekly Review. I'm Nathan Sterner. In today for Dan, welcome back. The White House yesterday said that more than 6 million people had signed up for medical insurance plans under the new health care law, Obamacare. Officials said demand for new policies has surged in recent days, with 1.5 million visits to healthcare.gov and 430,000 calls to call centers on Wednesday alone. Maryland has, of course, had a lot of problems related to the rollout of Obamacare here, but as the end of the enrollment period nears, there have been more signups. Last week, the state reported that more than 44,000 Marylanders had enrolled in new private insurance policies, while more than 203,000 had been enrolled in the Medicaid expansion for low-income people. State officials are set to give us another update later today. Peter Bielenson joins us now, a former Baltimore Health Commissioner and Howard County Health Officer. He now runs the Evergreen Health Insurance Cooperative, one of the choices that Marylanders have when they go into the marketplace to look for a health plan. Dr. Bielenson, Peter, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk specifically about Evergreen and your experience with the Affordable Care Act, let's look at the big picture. A federal website with lots of startup glitches, and in Maryland, a startup that was really kind of a disaster. And yet, nationwide, 6 million plus people enrolled overall. Maryland slowly but surely picking up significant numbers. Overall, what is your perspective on everything that's happened since the October rollout?
Well, I think everyone agrees that both nationally and locally, things didn't roll out terribly well. And I think there'll be a shakeout cruise to kind of finish up the last week or two of March, up to March 31st of the deadline. But I think if we look at back at this probably 3 or 4 years from now, people will just completely forget that there was a problematic rollout and that things have gotten better over time because the federal exchange is now working very well. It will continue to work well in the future years. I think people will gain confidence in the ability of the Affordable Care Act and its benefits that it brings. And the incentive of the tax penalty will grow from year to year. So this year, for example, if you don't sign up as an individual, the tax penalty is a $95 or 1% of your income. People seem to forget the 1% of your income, whichever is greater, because if you're making $30,000 a year, the penalty is not $95, it's $300. And for a family, it's over $2,000 a year. So there's some calculus that people have to make about affording health care or going bare, if you will. But in the out years, the next couple of years, the tax penalties are significantly higher. So I think confidence in the Affordable Care Act and the benefits that it brings, ease of signing up, and the incentive of avoiding a tax penalty by signing up will mean that things will be much better 2 to 3 years from now.
We mentioned the sign-up deadline is the 31st. That's this coming Monday. But here in Maryland last week, they have made things a little bit more flexible. I recall state officials saying that anyone who calls a hotline to get started on the process will be able to get coverage.
That's true. And the same at the federal level. The federal administration is offering a similar type of situation, where as long as you can say or attest that you've started by March 31st, you have basically till April 15th to finalize the enrollment and be covered by May 1st. In all honesty, it probably will not be that many people. This sort of thing happened back in January 1st, around January 1st, when the people had to sign up by December 31st to be eligible for health coverage beginning January 1st. Maryland had an extension period, similar to the one they're proposing now, and only a handful of people ended up participating in that. Now, the fact that we're coming up against a deadline for the year may mean that more people will take advantage of it, but I think it's not a huge, huge deal.
Tell us about Evergreen now. You've got an interesting model, but you're really kind of a new kid on the block for health insurance.
We are the new kid on the block, and we're competing on the exchange, which is, for those who don't know, the Travelocity of health coverage, which has not worked all that well here. Or nationally originally, but we're one of four companies that are on the Maryland State Exchange, United, Healthcare, Kaiser, CareFirst, and us. So obviously we're the new kid on the block. We're the first new commercial health insurer in 30 years in the state. So it's been an interesting competitive process. The exchange has hurt us, but we've been very nimble on our feet. And sort of the law of unintended consequences, when we can't get people through the exchange to sign up with us, we've switched and gone after small groups, small businesses, and that's turned out to be a very profitable market for us.
What were you planning on getting through the exchange? What were your hopes, and how has the rollout problems interfered with that?
Yeah, the hope and, frankly, the requirement from the federal law, which we were enabled under the Affordable Care Act, was about 2/3 of our policies to be sold on the individual exchange. That clearly is going to be difficult to manage, particularly because people who are individuals and families after March 31st, with a few exceptions, cannot enroll in private health insurance. You can enroll in Medicaid throughout the year, but private health insurance, March 31st is the deadline unless you have a kid turning 26 coming off their parents' plan or someone gets married or has a baby. But except for those life events, March 31st is the deadline. So whatever we've served up, whoever we've enrolled up till now is all we'll be enrolling for this year on the individual and family side.
On the individual and family side, what are you doing on other sides?
So the big thing we're pushing for is small groups. Or in other words, signing up small businesses.
How big is a small business?
Anything from 2 to 50 to 51. And we'll also be applying to be able to sell to large businesses. So it's, again, sort of the law of unintended consequences. When we ran up against a wall in terms of the exchange not being as not profitable, but as a real pipeline for what we had hoped, we've been able to switch and gone after small groups for which we're very competitive on the marketplace and hopefully for large groups as well.
How are your efforts going for small groups?
Small groups, we tripled our enrollment in about 2 weeks because I think what's happened – two things have happened very briefly. A lot of small businesses renewed their coverage early. So those who were going to normally renew their coverage in January, February, or March went early in November, December to avoid the Affordable Care Act. So we didn't have much business available till then. And now with many companies realizing they'd have to eat a lot of costs if they were supposed to open their enrollment again in April or May, they are doing renewals now. So that's a good market for us. And two, we're very competitively priced compared to the big guys. And third, the push for advertising that the enrollment is ending for individual and family coverage is getting people to think more about coverage as well. So all those things have led to pretty significant improvements in our enrollment.
You mentioned large businesses. What are you doing to attract large businesses?
Well, we have to be approved by the Maryland Insurance Administration. This has been a very interesting experience coming from the world of public health in terms of all the regulatory issues that are laid out before us. The Maryland Insurance Administration has been very supportive. But we have to have approval for each type of policy that we're selling. So we've had all of our individuals' policies approved, our small business policies approved, and we're now about to go in with our large group policies to be approved. And then we'd be able to sell to any organization, you know, from large companies to jurisdictions.
There's been a lot of talk about the so-called young invincibles and that they need to sign up in order to have this care work. The young invincibles being people who are relatively healthy, relatively young. How are things going on that front?
On the small group side, we're having a huge number of people who are in the young invincible crowd. But I would actually argue that they're not young invincibles. What we have found is that really they should be called the young affordables.
I think that makes more sense. I never really liked the young invincible
phrase.
And
it's really, we're finding this playing out in all of our outreach efforts. People like my son's age, 25, 26, my daughter at 29, they actually want to have health coverage. Their biggest concern is not that they're invincible and they're never going to need health care. It's actually the affordability of it.
It's that they're not making much money. I remember,
correct.
It wasn't that long ago that I was in that bracket myself, and
right.
That was the issue. It's so difficult to find health insurance obviously things were different then, but health insurance that was remotely affordable.
Right, but so what the real message that needs to get out to these young folks is that if you're making $25,000, $26,000 a year, with the subsidy that you'll be eligible for under the Affordable Care Act and the lower premiums because of your age, actually, it could be quite affordable. Probably, for some people, it may even be more affordable than paying the penalty on their taxes and having full coverage, of course.
What sort of ballpark are we talking about?
I hesitate to be to say exactly.
Yeah,
but
obviously.
Because it really depends on bronze, silver, gold, platinum plans and what your deductibles are, et cetera, et cetera. But you should, with subsidies, if you're a lowish income youngster coming out of college or coming out of your parents' plan at 26, 27, 28, you should be under $100 a month for sure in your premium with the subsidy included.
So that's the message you're trying to get out. Is that message really going forward?
I don't think it's gotten out as well as it should have, frankly. And again, sort of the die was cast because of the problems with the federal exchange initially and the state exchange for several months.
Drowning out
it's,
any
yeah,
sort of other
yes,
messages
that's
you've
exactly
been trying
right.
to get out.
And people have also lost confidence when, in fact, to be fair to the state of Maryland, the health exchange in Maryland is working better now. But because for 5 months it wasn't really working, people kind of had given up on it. So I think, again, the message is there's been sort of message fatigue about all the problems that have been going on. And people are not listening to the further messages about signing up and that it could be affordable because they're afraid they may not be able to sign up.
There have been repeated attempts in Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Political prognosticators think there is a pretty good chance that Republicans could gain the majority in the Senate after the midterm elections. They already have a majority in the House. If that happens, what is the fate of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think, first of all, it's veto-proof. If the Senate does go to the Republicans, and it probably, my guess is it will be 51-49 one way or the other, it clearly will be veto-proof. You know, the president will, you need 67 votes
to overturn a
veto,
and of course President Obama would veto
right,
any
right.
repeal.
Right, I'm sorry, it's not veto-proof. It would be hard to overturn the veto. So that's one thing on the political side. On the big political side, not the partisan political side, but on the big political side, 6 million people will have been signed up. Many, many, many millions will be signed into Medicaid and new expanded Medicaid. You'd have to be telling people if the Republicans truly want to overturn it and get the president, a Republican president elected in 2016, if that happened, for example, they would have to be throwing millions of people off of coverage that they didn't have before, and there would be a huge political firestorm. So I think in reality, Obamacare is here to stay. I would have wished it would have rolled out more smoothly. I think by 2016, people will have seen the benefits. It will be more easy. It'll be easier to sign up, and the tax penalties will encourage more people to sign on. And so I think, again, even as soon as 2 to 3 years from now, the rocky start will be a relatively distant memory.
So you sound like you're not terribly concerned about the political future of the Affordable Care Act.
No, I mean, for one thing, the reason I'm not particularly concerned is there. If you're going to get your position, if you're going to vote something down and get support from the general populace, you better have some kind of alternative around other than just, hey, get off your new coverage. And from what I can see, the Republicans have no plans that are forthcoming.
Also, an alternative would be something that could be constantly bickered over legislatively and would take a long time to go anywhere.
Right.
How long did it take the Affordable Care Act to go through? Years?
It really took about 100 years, to be honest. Started with Teddy Roosevelt's time. They've been working for universal health coverage, and it's only under President Obama that we got a significant step forward.
So the deadline for this current open enrollment period is
Monday. Of March 31st.
As I mentioned, yeah. There is a phone number you can call. It's 800-396-1961, so that if you get that process started, you'll have until
the 15th. I actually just called that number today, and they will call you back. You call, you register your name, and they'll call you back in the first week or two of April.
That number again is 800-396-1961. Peter Bielenson is CEO of Evergreen Health, online at evergreenmd.org. Peter Bielenson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Another quick break, then the Midday Weekly Review continues with a look at Common Core in Maryland, the court ruling on the big state center project, and Dogs and Richard III, a collaboration of the Baltimore Humane Society and the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory. Stay with us. I'm Nathan Sterner, keeping the midday host chair warm for Dan Rodericks this hour. Thank you so much for joining us. A 4-year battle over a $1.5 billion redevelopment project on Baltimore's west side at the site of the state government complex appeared to come to an end yesterday. There was an important ruling by Maryland's highest court in the dispute that pitted Orioles owner Peter Angelos and other owners of downtown office buildings against the state of Maryland and its plans to remake the government center along Preston Street near North Howard. Luke Broadwater, City Hall reporter for the Baltimore Sun, joins us now to talk about the ruling. Luke, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Just fine. Thanks for having me.
This project has been long, long time in the making, years, in fact. And the Maryland Court of Appeals, in its ruling yesterday, seemed to say that Mr. Angelos and others waited too long to challenge it.
Yes, that's right. I mean, so opponents of this project view the high court's ruling as sort of a cop out. They didn't deal with the actual issues that were raised about whether this was properly bid or not.
And that was the that was the issue that last year put this project on hold. A circuit court judge said that the project was not properly bid and against state law.
That's correct. And but what the high court said was basically you guys didn't have the standing to bring this because you waited too long to file it. They say we filed it as soon as was reasonable. As soon as the deal was inked, we filed it. But the high court disagreed, and obviously the developers disagreed. They felt like they had met for months and months with community members, had planned out this thing, and then got hit with a lawsuit that stalled it only weeks before they were about to break ground. So, you know, there's a bit of disagreement about that procedural matter, but what's important for the readers is that, and for the listeners, is that this huge massive development is now back on track. It looked like it was dead a year ago, looked like it was never going to happen, and now it's got the green light. So we could see a total remaking of the west side of Baltimore right by MLK over there.
Now, the bidding process was why it was put on hold, but what exactly were the objections aside from the bidding process that the people opposed to this project had?
Okay, so as you know, downtown Baltimore has a lot of vacancy in its office building, a lot of vacancies in the retail, and current property owners down there feel like, well, if we're going to build something else and have more retail space and more office space, won't that just make the problems of vacant offices worse? You know, the other side of that argument is that sort of the rising tide lifts all boats type of things. You build something great and it brings people in, and then nearby businesses benefit. It's not a zero-sum game. It's a game that everybody gets to win. But clearly, Mr. Angelos and different property owners down there disagree with that, and that's one of the reasons why they filed suit.
And the property owners are not happy with yesterday's ruling. Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake is, though. She was quite pleased.
Yes. So the mayor and Orioles owner Peter Angelos, who's also a big property owner and big-time lawyer, had a little sort of sparring session in the opinion pages of The Sun a couple years back on this. And, you know, the mayor basically blasted what she deemed frivolous lawsuits that were blocking development in Baltimore. And Angelos wrote back that, you know, this deal sort of stunk and that the taxpayers were getting stuck with excessive leases, and that the development was just sort of given to political cronies of those in power and not really competitively bid. One of the things he mentioned is that, you know, as a part of this deal, the developers get to charge above market rates to the state agencies that will be housed at this development, and he felt that was unfair to the taxpayers.
Do we have a timeline yet? You mentioned groundbreaking was about to begin when the circuit court stopped it. Is groundbreaking back on track?
Yeah, so I spoke with the lead developer yesterday about it, and she said they haven't set a date yet. Her name's Caroline Moore, and she said that they're investors are all still lined up, and they're ready to go. So, but as to an actual date, we don't have that just yet. But she seemed to think it would move pretty quickly at this point.
Thank you so much, Luke.
Thank you for having me.
Luke Broadwater covers city government for the Baltimore Sun. You can find a link to his story about State Center on the Dan Rodrick's Facebook page. Public school students across Maryland have been taking sample tests of the new assessments being introduced as part of the controversial curriculum changes known as Common Core. But many of their teachers say they are still having a difficult time grasping those changes themselves. Glynis Cousinjin had that story for MarylandReporter.com and is here to tell us more. Glynis, thank you for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Yourself?
Great, thank you.
So the state conducted a survey of teachers and principals asking them how familiar they were with Common Core. What did that survey reveal?
Well, I think it's important to first put the survey in context, which is that the State Department of Education was expecting Common Core to be fully implemented this school year. And out of the 60,000 teachers in Maryland, 60,000 according to who was surveyed, 9,232 teachers responded to the survey. And of those, less than a quarter said they were very familiar with Common Core, and about half said they were somewhat familiar with Common Core. And 20% said that they were not familiar at all with Common Core.
Not familiar at all with Common Core, with a set of standards that was supposed to be implemented this year.
That's correct. And then the survey also showed, and this is a direct correlation to those responses, that only 22% felt like they were very prepared to teach Common Core this school year, and 63% felt that they were somewhat prepared. 15% said they were not prepared at all to teach Common Core.
When was the survey conducted?
It was conducted in the fall and at the beginning of the school year.
So just as they would have been supposed to be launching into Common Core standards fully.
That's correct.
And 15% were completely not ready to do so at the beginning of the school year.
That's right. 15% were not prepared at all. And in fact, another question in the survey asked principals and school districts when they thought Common Core, the transition to Common Core was supposed to be completed by, and only 16% of school districts reported that they thought Common Core was supposed to be ready to go by the beginning of the school year. And only 19% of the principals said they thought Common Core was supposed to be fully implemented by the fall.
Why do you think this is? Why are so many teachers and principals unprepared?
I don't know, but there does appear to be a disconnect, as one board member pointed out at the meeting this week, and there seems to be a disparity across the entire state. Some school systems are actually really ready to go, and they have been transitioning Common Core since the state adopted it in 2010. And other school districts or local schools, or excuse me, individual schools, just haven't been prepared they just were not prepared for the transition. And another part of the survey actually says that only a third of the teachers felt like they had enough professional development to have them ready to go for Common Core. And this all is very consistent. It looks like basically, you know, about 25% of the teaching staff in the state felt like they were fully ready to go. And that's it.
Is the discrepancy at the county level or school by school for preparation?
I would say it's on an individual basis across the state. I did not see any results that showed school districts by comparison of school districts that they were compared that way in the survey. But when you read articles and you go to the legislative hearings and things of that nature, there's just an inconsistency of who's ready to go and who isn't ready to go.
How different are the Common Core standards from what was previously being taught?
Well, we are going to be putting out an article or a series of articles on that. That's one of the main questions that we're going to be focusing on, doing kind of a comparison and a contrast. So I can't really answer that right off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
That's fine. Of course, the MSA tests, the Maryland School Assessment tests that are being conducted this year are not for Common Core standards.
That's correct. Most of the curriculum this year, or a vast majority of the curriculum taught this year, is supposed to be taught on the Common Core standards, and the MSA tests are based on Maryland's old state education standards. So, of course, there was a lot of pushback from the teachers, but the state, you know, is going to go forward with what the state has already gone forward with giving the test.
Is there any reason to think that teachers and principals have gotten more up to speed on Common Core since the survey was conducted in the fall?
I don't know the answer to that, but the group that conducted the survey, which comes out of Towson University, they're going to be conducting another survey next month, sometime in April, and they're going to be checking to see how far along the schools and the teachers have come during the school year. And then they're also going to conduct another survey next fall. But I don't know what actions will be taken, and I don't know if any actions at all will be taken based on these current results. as far as getting, you know, I don't know what the state plans on doing as far as helping the teachers get up to speed more.
Glynis Cousinjin covers Common Core and other issues for MarylandReporter.com. You can find a link to her story on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page and, of course, through MarylandReporter.com, and that's where you'll have the coming series on the content of the Common Core standards, right?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Also, on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, a link to ticket information for the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's production of Shakespeare's Richard III. It opened this week and continues through April 19th at the Shakespeare Factory's home at the Great Hall of St. Mary's, 3900 Roland Avenue on the north edge of Hamden. The Baltimore Shakespeare Factory has an interesting collaboration going on with the Baltimore Humane Society. Some of the society's adoptable dogs have roles in the plays. Here to tell us about that, Wendy Goldband from the Humane Society. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, yourself?
Fine, thanks.
The cat will mew, the dog will have his day. That's Hamlet. Richard III, a dog has his day as well?
Yes, that's right. Jazz has his day in Richard III. He is playing young Richard's dog in the show.
How's he doing?
He's doing fantastic. He's quite a ham. We've chosen a good guy to debut.
What kind of dog is Jazz?
Jazz is a pit bull terrier mix. And actually, that's one of the things that we love about doing this with the Shakespeare Factory. It's a terrific opportunity to expose people to animals that might be considered a little scarier to some. Unfortunately, the pit bull terriers have been quite maligned recently. This is a wonderful opportunity to show how good and sweet and smart and lovable they are.
Is there actually a dog in the text of Richard III?
Yes, and that's really how this all began. The Baltimore Shakespeare Factory wanted to create their shows to be much more like they were when Shakespeare was actually alive, which meant using live animals and a lot more interaction. So rather than use one of their own pets in the show, they decided they'd help us out and try and expose the adoptable dogs.
This isn't the first time you've worked with them.
No, we've been working with them since spring of 2012, and it's been a terrific relationship. They're just fabulous to us.
Has Jazz had any reviews yet for his role in Richard
III? Haven't seen any come in, but that doesn't mean they're not out there. But I can tell you that everybody loves him.
They don't throw flowers onto the stage afterward? Milk bones? I don't know.
He'd much rather have the milk bones, that's right. No flowers, please.
Does Jazz have an understudy?
Jazz does not have a specific understudy, but I can tell you that we've got a whole slew of dogs waiting in the wings who can't wait to get some attention and be up there on stage.
Literally, so waiting in the wings? You have all these dogs beside the stage ready to shove them out?
No, not on the stage. Hopefully
nothing
will happen to Jazz while he's out there.
What does he have to do as Richard III's pup?
He has to take direction from Richard III, young Richard III. He is with Richard when the princess in the tower disappears. So I'm not really sure exactly if he has any speaking parts. I don't think he does.
Can you stop him from having a speaking part if he chooses to do so?
No.
I feel like he's got a lot of opportunity to ad-lib that most Shakespearean actors just don't have.
Well, that's right. Jazz gets to take a lot of license up there on stage. But the one thing he absolutely does do is give a lot of sloppy kisses to both the actors and to the audience during intermission.
Oh, he comes down off stage.
Yeah.
breaking that fourth wall.
That's right. He gets to greet the public.
So you've done this several times in the past. What other plays have pets taken roles in?
Well, we've done Macbeth. We've done A Midsummer Night's Dream. And actually, Midsummer Night's Dream, there was a child troupe that Baltimore Shakespeare Factory has as well. And one of our dogs starred with them.
What about cats?
They have had cats, but more in the background. They actually haven't played a significant role, but we have had some cats go out there.
They're a little bit more difficult, I would think, to...
Yeah.
As a cat owner myself, I wouldn't try to cue...
they stay in the cage, but there was one scene, I'm forgetting which play it was, with witches, and so the cats worked very well with that.
And Jazz is adoptable, too.
Jazz is absolutely adoptable. He's a terrific guy. He's really a sweet, sweet guy. Anybody will be very happy to adopt him.
If you're in the mood for Shakespeare, check out the information about the current production of Richard III featuring Jazz as the pet of young Richard at theshakespearefactory.com. Well, Wendy Goldband from the Humane Society, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's the Midday Weekly Review for Friday, March 28th. We break now for lunch, brought to us by Joe Squared, family-owned, offering coal-fired pizza and 17 varieties of risotto. Joe Squared is located at the Inner Harbor Power Plant Live and at Station North. NPR News is coming up in a moment, followed by Midday's second hour with a look at music in the digital age. I'm Nathan Sterner in this hour for Dan. Thank you so much for joining us.